Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
You're listening to the Yacht Racing Life podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. My guest this time is Phil Kennard, CEO of the Canadian North Star Sail GP team. A successful dinghy sailor in his own right, Phil has a breadth of commercial experience that spans 10 years in Formula One, as well as an extended stint at Golf's PGA Tour and a spell at Ben Ainslie's first America's Cup campaign. Who better than to quiz about the role of a SailGP CEO and to get the inside track on the Canadian team's roller coaster ride through season 5 and take a look ahead to their goals and aspirations for season 6. Phil Kennard, welcome to the Yacht Racing Life podcast. Thanks for joining us. We're going to talk about your role as the CEO of the North Star, the Canadian team, the Canadian SailGP team, which is known as North Star. So where are you talking to us from today?
Well, right now I'm back in London, as we're talking just before Christmas. So yeah, back here with the family for a few weeks before we jet off again for season 6 or 2026 season in a couple of weeks' time.
There's not much gap, is there, between the two seasons? And you guys have had everybody's had a busy 2025, season 5 season that just came to an end in Abu Dhabi last week. Is the travel element of it something you really enjoy?
I've always enjoyed travel. So, you know, throughout my career, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit, but I've always done a sort of traveling role, and I do enjoy that part of it. I think there's always a limit, though. There's a limit, and as life changes, and you know, I've got a young family now, you do have the kind of the draw of being back home. But SailGP is reasonably good. I mean, everybody says, oh, you're on the road a lot, but actually, you know, once a month, that's okay. And find me another role in the world where you don't have to travel once a month. So I don't find the travel too hard. But the point about Abu Dhabi gap to the next year is a good one, because there was almost, I think, the same the time between Cadiz and Abu Dhabi as there then was between Abu Dhabi and Perth. And for our team and North Star in particular, that's something that we couldn't really go up or down unless we started hitting everything in sight when we went to Abu Dhabi. We couldn't really go down, we couldn't go up. So we took the view that we were going to use that event as almost like a prequel to next season and treat it as part of next season rather than this season.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, let's get into a bit of that. I wanted to start off by just getting the potted history of your background, because it's a pretty interesting combination of some competitive sailing at the beginning and then some pretty cool jobs within mainstream sport, Formula One, PGA, and the America's Cup as well. So just talk us through, first of all, when did you get introduced to sailing? Where and when was that?
So that was probably as a kid. You know, in the summer holidays, your parents just don't know what to do with you and you've got kind of weeks on end. And I think my mum and dad packed me off on a sailing week sailing course, RWA level 1, probably as it was then, in the UK, down at Buell Water in Kent. So I started sailing there, and then was lucky enough to have the option of sailing when I was at school. When I got to about 13, the bug bit, and I started sailing 3, 4, 5 times a week almost. And you know, even if it wasn't available at school, I did it on the weekends, and I just really, really got into it at that point. So Loved sailing as a youngster. Did the usual sort of toppers, 420s, laser sailing. Did quite a lot of youth laser sailing. Never was never particularly good at that. But then I saw, as I think most people did in the 90s, the Aussie 18-foot skiff videos that were doing the rounds, and watching Chris Nicholson and Skild and Ella Bache and stuff like that. I kind of thought, well, I really wanted to go do that. And a 49ers had just come out, and I got the opportunity to go and crew a 49er, and then I was like, okay, this is where I need to be at, because I love speed. I love speed in sailing and everything I do. And so, yeah, got into 49ers.
Did you come from a sailing family? Was this a natural progression into sailing, or were you the first in the family?
First and so far last. Yeah, though I was from a racing family, really. My father did some motorbike racing when he was younger, and my brother has actually been a Le Mans driver and F1 test driver. So we're kind of more into the motorsport side as a family, but I just love sailing, and the opportunity it gave me as a youngster to kind of be in charge of your own destiny and make decisions and stuff like that. And I think that holds true for anybody. You know, when you get the opportunities that you wouldn't normally get in anywhere else to just go and control something on your own and make your own decisions as a teenager, it's fantastic.
So you headed off down the 49er route, and that must have led you almost inevitably into Olympic campaigning. How far did you get down that route?
We got a reasonable way. I ended up with a number of different helmsmen, but we got a couple of gold fleets at European Championships. I was in the Olympic development squad for about 3 years. But then there was a kind of realization that if I was going to come out of the 2004 games to kind of cycle and really, really actually commit to doing this, I'd have to beat Chris Draper and Stevie Morrison and all the rest of them. They were just so good at the time. And being from the UK, you've got a mountain to climb, because you've got to not only get your Olympic berth, but you've then got to beat all of the other top teams within your country to get that, to get the nod to go to the games. And so I kind of thought, well, am I actually really going to beat these people, or should I be doing something else with my time? And so, I took the decision back in sort of 2005 that it most likely was going to be 4 years of my life, not wasted. I wouldn't say wasted, because it would have been great fun, but I probably wasn't going to beat those guys. And so, you know, I'm probably going to do something else with my time.
So what was that? And by the way, that was, you were probably in Olympic campaigning in the 49ers at the very toughest time. That squad yeah. was incredible back then.
It was, you know, you had Paul Brotherton was still doing it. There was Alistair Richardson and Pete Greenhouse, Stevie and Ben, and then there were a whole load of youth people coming through. And Dylan hadn't even started sailing a 49er at that point, but John Pink had, and Rick Peacock. So yeah, I mean, our squad camps resembled a kind of a world championship every week down in Weymouth, which was immensely good for the level of the squad. But yeah, again, if you've only got one berth, then you have to have a good hard look at yourself. So after I stopped 49er sailing, I tried to get a proper job. So I went around the city of London thinking, well, you know, maybe I should go and do this, but that didn't really kind of fill me with joy. So I was lucky enough to get introduced to the head of marketing at the Williams F1, or BMW Williams F1 team as it was at the time. And I went along for what I just thought was a kind of a show round, and not really an interview, but I turned up, and it was the day after BMW had announced that they were leaving the Williams F1 team to go and buy the Sauber team. And a lot of the marketing personnel had seen their nice cushy jobs with their company BMW that was replaced every 3 months, and all of the extras that they had just suddenly disappear into smoke, and they decided to move on. And the head of marketing needed about 3 or 4 people to fill jobs instantly. And he said, when can you start? And I said, oh, really? Well, next week. So yeah, I honestly landed on my feet there and started just looking after sponsors, basically, which was something that I kind of dabbled in when I was 49er sailing. We managed to get a couple of people to come and help us out with the costs and whatever. But actually getting into the professional side of Formula One, I was incredibly lucky and just grabbed it and ran with it, basically. And I was at Williams for 5 years, initially doing sponsorship servicing, so looking after the current sponsors, one of which actually was Allianz. And Allianz were a sponsor of BMW Oracle in the 2007 America's Cup. So I got to go to Valencia to go and watch the Cup with them, which was an incredible opportunity. And I was, you know, see behind the scenes of how the commercial side of a Cup operation works. But then very quickly transferred out into business development, because I saw that that was where, if you want your career to accelerate in commercial side of sport, you need to be doing deals and going out and finding sponsors. So I moved into that pretty quickly. And loved my time working at Williams. It's still the team that's close to my heart. They're a great bunch of people.
And you stayed in Formula One. You went to Lotus as well. I think I heard that you were in Formula One for about 10 years.
Did 10 years in the end. I don't know whether I intended to do 10 years in it, but I did. And I actually left Williams and went to work for a marketing agency, which was run by Zak Brown, who now runs McLaren. So I worked for Zak for a year, which was an amazing experience and, you know, taught me an awful lot. But I missed the opportunity of being part of an actual sports team. And I think being part of an agency was great and an absolute fantastic learning experience. But I do love being part of a team. And the opportunity to go to Lotus came up. They had just got Kimi Raikkonen on board as their driver, you know, the famous "leave me alone, I know what I'm doing" kind of quote, because it was from when I was there. It was great to be back in F1, you know, with the team for another 4 years or so.
And then you got headhunted back into sailing with Sir Keith Mills called you and brought you back into Ben Ainslie's fledgling team, as it was back then. Two campaigns with them?
No, just the one campaign with them. So I joined Ben and was working with Ben and Joe Grindley for the 2017 Cup in Bermuda, and I think I started working with them from 2013 onwards. So yes, all of the sort of commercial development of that team from what was a very small lockup in Whiteley down in near Southampton to, you know, the big base that we then ended up having in Portsmouth. And it was amazing, because I think, and CJ has said this as well, that there comes a point where if there's going to be a British America's Cup challenger, you are a Brit, then you kick yourself if you weren't part of it. And it was, you know, what happens if it went on to be successful? And there were parts of that campaign that were fantastic. I mean, we won the World Series in Japan. And I remember that, you know, with the team felt like they were absolutely on top of the world and could do no wrong at that point. And we were going to the Cup and we were going to, you know, smash it. And there was an amazing feeling within that team. So it was a great time. Obviously, the boat wasn't quite where it needed to be. And obviously, the Kiwis came out with their cyclos, which blew everyone away. But yeah, it was a fantastic experience. And great to be part of an organization that was very entrepreneurial and starting from scratch. And I think that's, you know, when we come on to North Star, that's kind of where we're at with that team at the moment. But it was an opportunity to really roll up your sleeves and whatever needed doing, just you had to get on and do it. And I think that's incredibly exciting for anybody, really.
Now, have I missed out a stage? Was the PGA Tour before that, or was it after that?
No. So after 2017, I sat down with Ben actually in Bermuda, and he said, "Look, do you want to continue and go for the next Cup in, you know, wherever it happens to be?" Because we didn't know at that point, but it was looking pretty clear that it was going to end up being in New Zealand. And my honest opinion was that, well, we'd already re-signed quite a lot of the sponsors that we were going to need for the next campaign. And what obviously then ended up happening with Ineos and Jim Ratcliffe was different. But we had re-signed the likes of Land Rover and others. And I was looking at this thinking, well, what am I actually going to be doing for the next 2, 3, 4 years? You know, is this going to be mentally challenging for me? Even though my heart says yes, but am I going to be moving myself forward in my career? And at the same time, I had been approached by the US PGA Tour, who were looking for somebody who hadn't come from the traditional golfing background to run their business development function in Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And I just thought, well, this is an amazing opportunity again for me to learn another sport, to lead a team for the first time and lead an organization, or at least a part of it. and just continue my learning journey, if you like. So I kind of said thank you to Ben, and you know, we're still good friends, and we talk very often. It's a great relationship from that. But it was the right time for me to move on and learn something again.
So all of this experience, just I'm listening to you talking about the people and the sports and the exposure to all of that, it sets you up perfectly for SailGP coming along.
Not that I knew it at the time.
Not that you knew it at the time, no, but I'm beginning to think, when I look at the CEOs that are within SailGP, I think more and more it's going to be important who's in these roles, who's got the experience, who's got the experience to shape teams, because it's more than just the sailing now, isn't it? It's everything counts.
It is. I think these SailGP is obviously still very young. I did actually go to the launch of SailGP back in, what was it, 18,
yeah,
by Tower Bridge, that launch. Yeah, I was there at the time, and I actually kicked myself, and I was thinking, God, have I made the wrong decision to go and work for the PGA Tour at the moment? Because, you know, there's these new teams starting, and that's kind of what I want to do eventually. And so, but SailGP is still very young. I mean, it's only 5 years or five seasons old, longer because of COVID, but it's still only 5 seasons old, and it's got a huge amount of growing still to do. But what I think everyone will see is that the individual teams themselves will start taking on more of their own identity, more of their own operations. They will grow as businesses within their own right and as teams within their own right within SailGP. Because, you know, the genius of SailGP was that Larry and Russell started it with all these teams being owned by the league, and they've now subsequently started selling them off. And the ecosystem that SailGP has now is getting larger and larger, and there's just so much opportunity in it that the teams are going to start to grab and take hold of and run with. It's having people on every team who can just keep their eyes open and wide to all opportunities, I think, is going to be good, whilst still remaining true to the core sporting element of what the sports team actually needs to be.
So how did it come about? How did you get involved with the Canadian team as it was then, and it's evolved into being North Star?
Yeah, so I think towards the beginning of last year, so 2024. So beginning of 2024, I'd been at the PGA Tour for longer than I was expecting to be. We'd been through kind of three periods. One was pre-COVID, then there was the COVID point, and then there was the post-COVID and live golf period, where Liv and the PGA Tour were going at it hammer and tongs, and it was a very, very challenging place to be and a challenging environment to work within. And I had come to the realization that probably time was running out on my time there, and it was time to look for something new. And so I'd been personally kind of interested in looking at sports investment, and you know, you'd seen a lot of sports teams and entities being bought, sold, traded, whatever, and I felt that it was a good opportunity or a good time to move into that world and combine my knowledge of sailing, Formula One, golf, etc., within a sports investment vehicle. I was actually introduced to Dr. Greg Bailey by mutual acquaintance who works with him, and was told me that Greg was looking to start this sports investment company, and would I be interested in taking a meeting and having a coffee with him? And the answer is always yes when somebody says they want to do that. And the initial discussion with Greg was actually around Formula One and whether I would be able to help him to get a small stake in an F1 team. And we actually got a reasonable way down the road of looking at Formula One. We had discussions with about three or four of the different teams, but I think when it came down to it, what Greg would have got for his investment with an F1 team would have been a tiny minority stake and no control or anything like that, no active role within the team. And Greg is, as I now know, is a very active guy. He's a participant in all of his investments and his businesses. And so he quickly came to the realization that probably wasn't the right thing. And then credit has to go to the German SailGP team, who had reached out to Greg via a fund that they work with to offer him a minority stake in their team. And Greg pinged this across to me and said, hey, you know sailing, what do you think of this? And I looked at it and I said, well, actually, I do think SailGP is kind of interesting. It's going places. It's, you know, if you looked at it as an investment proposition 2 or 3 years ago, it was a very risky one. You know, it was unproven. Yes, valuations were much lower than they are now, but it was probably, it was a bit of a punt if you were going to get into it at that point. Whereas now, it, you know, especially post the sale of the US team, it felt like the league had grown up very quickly and it become an investment class or a vehicle that sophisticated investors could actually take a look at. It's not fully baked yet, and it's still got a long way to go in its journey. But it was the right point where if you were entrepreneurial and if you were going to take a little bit of a risk on it, then it potentially could be a good investment. But we still had the same problem we had with F1, where if Greg had taken a minority stake in Germany, he wouldn't have been in control of the team. And I said to him, this is great, but if you're looking at SailGP, why don't we go and have a look and see what else is available? Because they're, you know, just firstly, we need to weigh out the pricing of what the German offer is. And so we did that. We went around and we actually spoke to the league. We spoke to some other teams. And it became clear that the Canadian team was for sale. And Greg is from Toronto. And so there was a kind of realization for him that he could own the home team, which, you know, he always says this is not an ego play. It's not an emotional play. But at the same time, it is the home team. And so for him, so he basically said, look, let's explore that further. And very quickly, we got to a point with Russell where we had a term sheet. We started doing due diligence. And we actually had that done during the Canadian event, the Halifax event of 24. It was 24, wasn't it? So we actually had that, you know, that was ongoing during that time. And just seeing the strength of feeling of the fans and that event in Halifax, I think that really convinced Greg that this was something that would be a good thing to get involved with. And so very quickly after that, the deal was done and he acquired the team.
Yeah. I met a few of the Canadian fans along the way at a few events and they are very passionate. I mean, they've really, really adopted the sport and the league and get fully behind it. I can see not a bad time to be trying to convince somebody to join the league when you've got that kind of enthusiasm going on at an event in your home country.
No, absolutely. And we're really looking forward to Halifax next year as well. I think I would say this because we are the Canadian team, but I do think it's going to be one of the highlights of the season just because of the strength and the passion of the fan base there. You know, tickets sold out very, very quickly. Again, you know, even though the size of the grandstand has sort of gone up five times from what it was, all the tickets were in 24. So yeah, we're definitely looking forward to that, and it's a sort of perfect amphitheater for the racing.
Before we move on from Greg, what exactly can you kind of sum up what it was he was looking for? You mentioned sporting investment.
Yeah.
What was he trying to achieve?
So Greg is a very, very interesting guy. He made the bulk of his money through pharmaceuticals and biotech. He's been, as he says, lucky enough to go through, I don't think it's luck, I think he's very good at what he does, but he's been lucky enough to go through, I think, two of the top 10 biotech deals of the last 10 years from his companies that he's owned, and obviously done very, very well out of that. But he's now absolutely committed to helping people live longer and more healthily. So he's all about longevity. He's now one of the world experts on longevity, and he invests significantly of his own time and capital into this sort of plan that he's got to try to help people live better and longer. In essence, is one of the sponsors on our boat. You'll see that again next year. Now, when you're investing in biotech, You the best way to do it is to divide your bets up among a number of different drugs and therapies. So you're not going to put literally all your eggs in one basket, right? You're going to go and look at a whole suite of 10 or 12 or 15 different drugs that are in development and split the money up that way. So what he needs to do is to find people who join him on that journey and will also co-invest with him on various different things. And he was looking at, where can I find other people who will come and join me and join in this kind of journey to make people live longer? And you look at the high net worth sports that are out there, it's likely it's Formula One or it is LGP. And because of what we just mentioned about the kind of the relative price points of the investments, the LGP seemed to be the optimal place for him to start and to try and find co-investors. So that's his main draw, is to do that. But it's also to inspire people to go and live longer and healthier and look after themselves and get out there, not just in sailing, but just get outdoors, get active and whatever. So he's very passionate about that.
So it sounds like he's an active participant in all of this. He must be on site at the events regularly, I would guess.
Yeah, he is. He comes to probably 75-80% of the events per year, which is pretty good. So and we enjoy having him along. He's a great sort of chairman of the team, and he can often be found in the hospitality or in the team base. So yeah.
And at the end of this first season with the team, what's his feedback? What's his reaction been to the experience?
I think I'll take you through the journey of the season, if you like, because it kind of has changed as we've gone through. And, you know, when we started off in Dubai last year, we didn't really know what was going to happen. I think we came sixth or seventh or something in the first event, which was kind of, it's okay. You know, it wasn't, you know, neither fantastic nor terrible. And then from there onwards, you know, we went to Auckland and suddenly the wheels fell off and we you know, because we had an injury to Billy, we couldn't sail for the whole of the Sunday. We were not yet in a position as a team where we were resilient enough in terms of the people on the team to be able to continue. We didn't have enough training on flight controllers and all kinds of other stuff. And so that was a real awakening that, goodness, this is actually really hard. There's an awful lot of teams that are doing this and have been doing it very well for a long period of time. And if we thought we were going to come in and just, you know, blow everyone away, then, you know, not that we did, but, you know, we suddenly realized this is going to be quite a journey to try to make this team competitive and consistently competitive. And actually, Giles said something to me early in the season. He said, you have to treat CLGP like one long regatta and each event is one race. And you don't get upset when one goes badly. You don't get too excited when one goes well, but you just got to keep level all the way through and just keep plugging away, because you just never know what's going to happen around the corner. And that's actually been quite good advice for what then transpired, which was, you know, we went into Sydney and we made a lot of changes before Sydney last year, earlier this year. And suddenly we found ourselves just scraping onto the podium. And that was fantastic. You know, first podium, really, really great. Then we nearly won it, which was one of the amazing things about the format. You know, you don't have to win every race. You just have to win the last race in order to take an event. So that was a bit of a springboard for us that, yeah, okay, we're not there yet. I mean, the Aussie sales are an incredible series.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
And, you know, frankly, they should have probably won the event. But we kind of felt that we had something. Then we went to Los Angeles and managed to win the event. And followed that up with a second place in San Francisco. And, you know, there was a feeling there that, yeah, we're onto something here. We're only a few points off the top three in the championship. Okay, this is going well. Got to New York and suddenly again we're back crashing back down. And we were trying to work out exactly why this is the case. Why it's so hard to put a consistent performance in across lots of events. And I think it's because of the data that you have in CLGP, because any time that a single team finds even a little tiny advantage, within 20 minutes, every other team knows about it, and they're training and they're finding a ways to copy you and to go another stage farther. So no advantage is there for long. And so that's where it's really hard to keep consistently at the front, because everybody's trying hard. They're all pushing super hard. They all want to win. And there's no slow coaches out there, you know?
That seems to throw the emphasis away from the sailors a little bit and onto the data analysis, the backroom analysis of all of this data that's going on. And just to try and find, you know, lift up the floorboards and find this potential advantage. But then that's got to be validated by the sailors. And it's not an America's Cup campaign where you can go and spend a week on the water trying something out, two-boat testing. You get maybe a day, a few hours of time on the boat. That's hard to balance, isn't it?
Yes, and actually we were laughing about it the other day when we were in Abu Dhabi, the Friday of Abu Dhabi. I think we got 45 minutes of sailing. So how can you move yourself forwards as a team if you're actually sailing for 45 minutes a day? So it's incredibly difficult. And I know the league are really pushing hard to get everyone more training time. But with the logistics of getting the boats from one place to the next, to the next, to the next, it's almost impossible to do. And so I know they've got some plans on how they're going to solve that, because, you know, that's something for future generations, or not even generations, but for our pipeline of talent. It's really hard to get young people out of sailing Olympic classes, WASP, MOS, switches into an F50, because the step change is just so high and there isn't enough time to go and train. But, you know, back to your point, yes, data is really, really key. And we took a view quite early on that, you know, maybe because I come from an F1 background where data is absolutely key, I said, right, we're going to need to have the data analyst. We're going to need to have somebody who's, you know, actually coding and creating our own tools and our own suite of tools that sit on top of the Oracle data. So every team gets access to the same Oracle data, but it's what you do with it that matters. Mm. And so how can we gain an advantage, or at least get up to the level of those powerhouse teams in SailGP and what they're doing? How do we shortcut that, get to that point, and understand what nuances there are and what things are going to make a difference to us? And we're not there yet, but we've made some significant advances on the data side of things across this year.
Is there a lot of secrecy around what people are doing on that side of things? I mean, we talk in general terms about, yeah, you've invested in more in data analysis, but are the powerhouse teams, as you call them, are they doing something but you're not sure what it is?
Well, we don't know. So I think there is quite a lot of secrecy around it, yes, because, you know, SailGP, as you said, it's not like America's Cup. You can't go back in the shed and tweak your foils or tweak your boat or your sail plan or whatever. You can't touch it. I mean, you cannot touch your boat. And that's one of the beauties of SailGP, is that the equipment is all the same. You know, all the boats are equal weights. They're all set up with the same geometry on the foils and the rudders. We cannot do anything to them. So it's all in how your team apply themselves and the way that they sail the boat. And so finding little tiny bits of advantage is really, really hard to do, and it's one of the only areas that we've got in order to actually find performance advantage over other teams is in the data.
And then the added complication to all of that is that the playing field's never the same, is it? It's a different venue. It's different wing conditions. You've got different wing configurations. You've possibly got different foil and rudder configurations. It's an awful lot for these teams, the sailors, the tech teams, to have to deal with, isn't it?
It is, and you're right. You know, we're going to a Sassnitz versus a New York versus an Abu Dhabi. I mean, it's you wouldn't get a football team going and playing in an octagonal pitch one week and then a triangular pitch the next week, and it feels like we're kind of doing that, but that's what sailing is, right? That's the exciting bit of it, is the number of differences there are, you know, within our sport, whether it's the wind, waves, tide, you know, you name it, it all changes. And you throw into that the configuration changes you just referred to, and it does make it very, very challenging. And the league keep us on our toes by Russell keeps on putting new bits of kit on the boat. So we have to continually have to learn something new, whether it's, you know, it's big T4s and big rudders in Switzerland, or the 27.5 meter wing config in Abu Dhabi. So I love that about SurgeyP, that it's continually moving forwards. It could just sit there and, you know, be the same boat, you know, year in, year out, but it's not, and it's moving, which I think will keep it fresh in the long term as well, which is great.
And that's one of the attractions, one of the benefits of SailGP, is because it's effectively a privately owned organization, decisions can be made quickly and new ideas can be implemented very quickly. And you know, as compared to, obviously, we're going to compare it with the America's Cup, where change is pretty difficult within that competition. So, yeah, I think there's lots of benefits to that. All of the stuff we've talked about now, lots going on, lots of decisions to be made, lots of stuff to react to, that ultimately all filters back to the CEO role, doesn't it? Can you describe what your role is? If you were describing it to somebody who doesn't know the sport, how would you describe it?
Good question. It feels sometimes like I have an awful lot of hats to wear, but, you know, ultimately, you know, you, as the CEO, you've got finance, legal, HR, marketing, and then the actual sporting side of the organization, all sort of reporting into you. But because we're a small organization, I am finance, I am HR, I am legal. those three things I have to take care of all the time. And then the other areas, for example, in marketing and sponsorship, business development, we do have a team who are fantastic, who are working within North Star doing those particular roles. And then obviously the sporting side, we have underneath Giles. So Giles runs that for our team, and he's got all of the data analysis and the coaching side with led by Joe. And then, you know, all the development of sailors under him as well. So when we acquired the team, everything flowed into me, and that was untenable in the end. Yeah. You know, we had to find ways to manage it better. And so we've as our team, as North Star, we've actually made some quite big changes to how we're structured between Cadiz and Abu Dhabi. And so I know Giles has sort of referred to some of the things that we're doing differently to try and get out of a bit of a slump in form that we had later on in the year. And some of that is just tiny nuances, but it's little things about who's responsible for what, who takes leadership, et cetera. And yeah, I think we're making some good gains there.
What goes on with the team in between events? Because obviously the focus is on the event where people watch online, they watch on TV. And then there's a down period, you know, a couple of weeks maybe to the next event. I'm kind of conscious that most of these teams don't have a team base, you know, and most people aren't going back to a central point. How do you operate within North Star?
It's a good question. And yeah, we're definitely one of those teams that doesn't have its own team base. You know, the Canadian team has a majority of the people who work for it in Canada, but there are some elsewhere as well. Our head of marketing, Jen, lives in Italy for the majority of the year before she goes out to Canada in the summer. Yeah, and there are others based different places around the world. I'm obviously based in the UK. So, but we get together as much as we can online. We tend to split up into our various work streams, whether that's marketing and you know, the performance side of the team, the sailing side of the team will meet. And they will talk, you know, through, you know, what they've got to do and try and find their gains, etc. We've got our data analysis team get together, you know, and then there's obviously the shore crew as well, who we keep in communication with. But they're on the road even more than the sailing team are, because they arrive, you know, 4 or 5 days in advance of the event, and they leave 3 days afterwards. So they do travel a lot, and so their downtime between events is far less. But it's not, I don't really feel like it's downtime between the events. It feels like it's just a continuous churn. Otherwise, there's always stuff to be done, whether it is, we're actually, this is a bit of a teaser. We're completely changing our livery for our team next year. So we've been signing that off. Boat's just been painted in Abu Dhabi, which is very exciting. Just seeing pictures of that. So that whole process has been going on for a while now to make sure that it's exactly what we want. And that's taken some time. Obviously, we're continuously out talking to potential sponsors and partners and investors in the team as well. But ultimately, we're also trying to move the performance of the team on as well. And so one of the recent changes we made to the team was to bring in Ian Williams as a starts coach. So he's been working with Joe, with Giles and the rest of the team on specifically on that and how we can improve our starting performance going forwards as well. So there's a huge amount that goes on between all the events. And that's before you even get to planning of next year and the overall strategy of the team. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of stuff, and it seems to me it's only going to get busier as the league develops. We get more teams and you know, potentially more events if the logistics allows for that. How much do you take a big picture view of things? It's, you know, you've just completed your first full season. You're kind of a mid-table, you know, an upper to mid-table team at this point. Is there an overall plan that you can share? Is it a 3-year plan, a 5-year plan?
Yeah, so there's kind of splits between the sporting side of the team, sporting plan and what we do there, and then a business plan. The sporting plan is obviously to what we term become a powerhouse team in our own right. So we want to be spoken of in the same breath as the Aussies, the Kiwis and the Brits. They're definitely the, you know, head and shoulders above everyone else that they have been this year, especially if you look at the results and the statistics. So how do we turn ourselves into that? What do we need to do in order to do that? And what changes do we need to make? We have made a couple of changes to our team for next year. Nothing drastic. We haven't gone and got a new wing trimmer, but we have tweaked where tweaking was felt to be the right thing to do. And hopefully, from a performance point of view, we'll start the season in a really good spot, because we've got a good level of kind of solidity and continuing with the bulk of the same team for next year. Now, actually, if you look at the kind of the results in SailGP, SailGP does tend to reward teams who keep their group together and they keep learning as a group, and they don't change things too often for the sake of it. You know, you get maybe a bit of a flash of excitement when somebody new comes in, and then all of a sudden it goes away again. And it's about building that group together and their core values, what they believe in as a team, and so they're operating almost as one. You don't get that overnight. So we felt it was important to keep the core of the team together. Confidence in everyone. So that part, I think, is almost, I'll leave it to Giles and Joe to lead, but that part's being taken care of, I hope, and they're going to be doing a great job on that this year. From the business point of view, we're definitely seeing this as a sort of 5 to 7 year kind of plan. And I kind of take a step up from just North Star into what we want to do across our holding company. So from our point of view, we see SailGP as this incredible kind of center of the wheel, if you like, of sailing. You know, it's the bright light in sailing at the moment. It's doing fantastic things. It's got a great future, but there's a whole load of stuff around SailGP which needs some help, and there's opportunity, frankly, from our point of view. And so we've made a sort of 3 or 4 sort of significant moves, we feel, in the sport. One is to take a look at media and how media is actually covering SailGP and so covering sailing in general. And in the main, there's relatively little media coverage of what actually goes on in SailGP. Certainly not enough for the excitement that actually you get whilst watching it. So we've sort of taken the step of creating a new business around sailing media, which we'll be launching in January. It's going to be called The Foil, and a number of different contributors are already signed up and part of that. So I'm quite excited to see how that goes. And that's completely separate to North Star, but that's from a kind of a holding company point of view. And our hope there is that it just helps to lift the kind of exposure that SailGP gets and America's Cup and all the rest of the top level sailing. So I'm quite excited to see where that goes. The third one is around, so we've got team and media, and then the third area is around events themselves. And this goes back to my background with PGA Tour. If you look at PGA Tour, they've got when I left, there was 144 events a year on the PGA Tour and associated tours. But they only run 4 of them a year. So the PGA Tour actually doesn't run many events. They'll run the Players' Championship, the Tour Championship, the President's Cup, and you know, a couple of others. So they don't run very many events. What they do is they use individual promoters in various areas to actually take over running of each individual event. And SailGP, I think, will end up moving in that direction, because as SailGP grows and starts taking on more and more events, it's going to be practically impossible for one organization to actually run 14, 15, 16 SailGP events a year. They'll have to use local promoters. And so we would love to, as an organization, to actually start to look at taking over the promotion of one or two events on the SailGP schedule and put those within our business. So that we're having some discussions about that. You may have noticed in Abu Dhabi, we had Sports Illustrated on the wing of our boat. That's a new partnership, which will formally be launched in a couple of weeks' time, or just after the new year. Sports Illustrated, one of the best party companies in the world, would you believe now? So if you go to any, you know, the NFL, the Super Bowl, or you go to Miami F1, the evening party that you want to go to is the Sports Illustrated party. And so we've done a deal with them where we're going to be doing some Sports Illustrated parties around SailGP events going forwards. And the first one of those is going to be in Dubai next year, up with some more in 2027. So kind of excited about that. It's just building out this ring around SailGP and what it can be, so that when you get to 5 p.m. on the Sunday evening at the end of SailGP, all the 2,000 people in hospitality don't go, okay, what do we do now? And there's nothing there for them. So this is kind of the next obvious step. And it's what you get when you go to a Formula One race. You go to the Amber Lounge or whatever it is afterwards. And there isn't that in SailGP. So we're quite excited about that. And then the final piece is we just announced a partnership with Waterspeed. And some of you may know Waterspeed and what it is. It's kind of like the Strava for water sports. So you can track your wing foiling session, or you can track your kite foiling session, or whatever you're going to do, or your sailing session, and you share it with your friends. You can connect with equipment manufacturers, you can connect with your coach, all that kind of stuff. And so we've become an equity partner in that business as well, and so that forms another part of our kind of strategy across the whole of sailing. So it probably wasn't where we were initially looking to go, to build out this whole business around SailGP, but it's just, as I go back to those entrepreneurial kind of opportunities that just come up, and you think, actually, that would be a really good idea, and it would add something to our proposition. So,
wow, that's you've really surprised me. I was aware of the foil, but the other stuff, for sure, is really interesting. And I guess it's a testament to SailGP's success that these sort of opportunities are growing out around it. I think most people in its first season were a little skeptical whether it was going to survive beyond that. As each season has gone on, I was a skeptic early on, and I pretty quickly came around to to recognizing it, for what it is. And it's tremendous to see the success of it in season 5 and going into season 6 with these sort of opportunities and these sort of conversations happening.
Yeah, it's not traditional sailing, right? You can't look at it with a traditional sailing hat on. It's not Cowes Week or, anything like that. It is something completely different. And if you look at it through the lens of an entertainment property that transcends sailing across into, motor racing audiences or general sports audiences, then you suddenly, if you look at it through that lens, I think you can understand it more. Some of the ideas that they have about propulsion systems, for example, for light airs. I'm a traditional sailor. I think that fills me with dread, that idea.
Yeah.
But we'll give it a go because, at the same time, I used to love Formula One before DRS. And I thought the idea of having DRS as a button you press and the rear wing opens and you go faster and make an overtake, that's crazy. That's not overtaking. That's just push to pass. I don't, but actually it's turned Formula One into a much bigger sport, something that people engage with more, and they do like watching overtaking, and it's part of the strategy of when you use it, how you use it, all that kind of stuff. And I think we need to look at SailGP as they're giving it a go, right? And they're trying different things, and some will work, some won't, but it's worth giving a go and seeing what that looks like. Because if you can open up the calendar to venues that aren't blessed with 15, 20 knot winds every single day metronomically, then it just gives you more opportunity from a commercial basis to grow it, and also to keep that schedule going throughout the year, because, you know, there's very few venues you can go to in this November and December that aren't in Australia, New Zealand. We go to those already. So, you know, you need to find other venues around the world that will work. And I do applaud CLGP for trying things and seeing whether it works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is the best chance for sailing to be a commercially viable product. And as you say, I mean, lots of people complained about Abu Dhabi and Dubai as being light wind venues. You just got to look at the social media feeds to see the vitriol that was thrown at the league. But the reality is, both from a commercial point of view and just a practical point of view, as you say, these are the venues that have to be incorporated into the calendar, and that's not going to change, I don't think.
It won't change, but there will be other venues in the Middle East that do have some better wind that may well come on the schedule at some point, I'm sure. And variety is the spice of life, right? If we went to places like, you know, Tastes was incredible, and the breeze there, it was one of those days where watching from the shore, you were looking downwind, and if you can see white horses looking downwind, you know it's breezy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it was one of those days, and I remember looking out thinking, well, if only all the events were like this, because it was an incredible scene. But then you do have to balance it, and I agree that two holes in the water crawling around like we had in Geneva, for example, that's not in anyone's interest. We don't want that. We don't want new fans of the sport logging on for the first time, seeing the racing for the first time, and seeing a crawling around snooze fest. You know, that's not right. But the Sunday in Abu Dhabi, there was nothing wrong with that racing, and actually the final was very tense. Right, it was incredible. It was tactical. It was, you couldn't really ask for more in terms of that, apart from a bit more speed. So, yeah, I think there's tweaking to be done, and CLGP will get there. But there's commercial realities also that need to be balanced.
So, looking ahead to 2026 from a North Star point of view, what goals have you all set for the team?
Oh, this is one where you're going to come back to me at the end of the season and said, you said you would be.
I'm not that slick. I'm not that good.
No. So it's a good question. I think, we finished this season in sixth place in the championship, kind of a B-, must do better on the scorecard. So I think we feel like we had a challenging time through kind of the September period where we were in Saint-Tropez, Geneva, Cadiz, but there were glimpses of what we could do. And CLGP has pretty much become a starting competition, first and foremost. Mm. If you can get off the line, you can get a good result. And actually, if you delve into the data of the starts, average position of Mark One is surprisingly low. For example, I think, and I'm gonna, don't quote me on this, but I think the French are actually the best starters in the fleet. They've got an average position at Mark One of like 5.09 or something like that. It's quite low, right? It's not amazing. And we, as North Star, we're eighth in the leaderboard on starts position of Mark One, and ours is 5.6. So it won't take much to move yourself up and to be, a better starter if you can just tweak something a little bit in the starts, and then you're away to the races. So, it's also very clear when you watch CLGP and you have your own team kind of front and center in your mind, you're only looking at the position that your own team is in. And quite often you'll find people saying, well, you didn't get very good starts that day. You look at the data and actually you were kind of second or third on the starts list, because it's very hard to actually see with the naked eye who's getting good starts and who isn't. But it's obvious to us that starts are paramount for performance. And so that's why we got Ian Williams to come and join us. He's specifically looking at starts, how we set up for the starts, what the game plan is, and that perfectly fits with Joe and his role as lead coach as well. So really kind of keen to see how that develops. I mean, we've done only a few days with Ian so far, and I felt that when we were in Abu Dhabi, our starting performance had taken a decent step on. And you know, you could see that in, I think it was the first start on the Sunday, we got an absolute cracking start and led at Mark 1 by a mile. So, you know, hopefully we can replicate that and do more of that. But the other thing is, for me, Giles is an incredible talent, but he's actually not been in CLGP that long. You know, if you look at the number of race starts he's had, he's done a season and a half compared to the likes of, Tom Slingsby or Pete or, you know, those guys. They've done a huge amount of events. So I think as the races go forwards and we get more experience as a group sailing together, we're going to get better and better. I'm going to say it now. I really do hope that this time next year we would have been pushing at getting into that top three at the end of the season. I think that's all you can really hope for as a team. Once you get in the top three, anything can happen, right? But I think, you know, if as long as we're in the discussion through the late end of next year in terms of, you know, getting up towards the grand final, then I think that would have been a good season for us. So just want more consistency. We want to be able to operate better as a team throughout the year, not have quite so many highs and lows that we had this year. I think that would be a good season for us.
Yeah, consistency. That's that.
Yes,
the golden ticket, isn't it? That's so hard to so obvious, but so hard to achieve. Well, Phil, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been really interesting. It's great to get an inside view from the top of a SailGP team. The very best of luck for everything next year. We'll be back into it pretty soon, and we'll be watching.
Thanks, Justin. Take care.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview, but in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.